I want to talk to you about the value of the soul and the reading that was read a few moments ago reminds us of a great fact about our soul. Last Sunday, we had an excellent lesson about the spiritual heart, the heart of the Bible, in which Frank talked about the intellect and the will and the emotion and the conscience that are all part of the Bible heart. And of course, all of those terms are applicable to the soul. And so this is not unlike talking about the soul. But the text I want us to look at is just what was read to you. What is a man profited if he gained the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? The soul of an individual is that which we should value above all else. And so our study today is designed to help us, to help me and to help you to think about the proper value that we place upon our soul. It is very easy for us to get so caught up in the affairs of life that we spend nearly all of our attention thinking about our health and our well-being and making a living and all of those things, and not place the proper emphasis upon the soul. The second great purpose is to value the souls of others. When we look at other people, and as we think about their welfare, do we think about the welfare of their souls? And then the third purpose is to encourage holy thinking and holy living, the way of life that we are involved in, according to the prophecy of Isaiah. And a highway shall be there and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. And so it is not too much for us to think about, as we think about our souls, that the way of holiness is to concentrate as much as we possibly can upon the value of our souls and our spiritual life. And so that'll be our topic this morning, and we'll be looking together about various things that come out of this passage with a little thought that teach us about the value of the soul. In the first place, things are valuable because of durability. Our souls were designed to last forever. God has designed a part of you and me that will exist forever and forever. Over in the book of Genesis, chapter 2 and verse 7, the Lord God formed man of the dust of the earth, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. And so the soul is the essence. It is the you and me. It is the part of us that God designed to live forever. We are housed in this tabernacle of clay. We are housed in a human body for a period of time. But the soul is designed to last forever and forever. We value a thing for its durability because of its workmanship and the fact that it will last for a long time. There are violins that have lasted for centuries, and they are very valuable because they are durable and the quality is such that they last on and on. I received an email from a friend recently and a picture. And it was a picture of a Rolls Royce, a 1929, that this man's father had bought for him when he was 19 years old. And he was about 100 and had to give up driving, but he had driven that car for more than 80 years. Maybe you got that same email. Now, that's durability, isn't it? To design a motor car that one could drive. It was the only car he ever had. He drove it all of his life, more than 80 years. That is amazing. It is a feat of engineering that there could be a car designed to last for 80 years. But God designed a soul that will last forever and forever. There is an old song that says, when we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less time to sing God's praise than when we first begun. And so my soul and yours, there is a part of you and me that will exist through the unending ages of eternity. And so durability is in this passage. Demand determines value. When the well is dry, water is very valuable. If you are in the middle of the desert, then water becomes very, very precious to you. And the demand for our souls was so great that Jesus valued our souls so much that he gave his life. For as much, Peter writes, as you were not redeemed with silver and gold from your vain conversation received by tradition from the fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without spot and without blemish. And so Jesus valued our souls so much that he gave his life that you and I might be saved. And the part of us that he was interested in saving was not our physical earthly bodies, but our soul. In fact, Jesus showed the contrast between the two as he talked to his disciples and said, "Do not fear those who can kill the body but are not able to destroy the soul." And so Jesus died for my soul and for yours, that we might be saved forever and forever. And so demand determines value. Distinctiveness determines value. If there is only one of a certain painting or a certain sculpture, then that becomes very valuable, doesn't it? And the fact that what is rare is more valuable generally is interesting to us. It is true that you are an original. There is no one else who is just like you or me. Sometimes people say, "Oh, I'm thankful for that." And I knew a gospel preacher of whom a brother said, "Well, I love Brother Pittman, and he's a wonderful man. But if I were making 1,000, I wouldn't make another just like him." And Brother Pittman was a wonderful man, but he was very eccentric. And so the brother who said that about Brother Samuel Pittman was saying that he is one of a kind. He is original. And you are one of a kind. You are very special. Every individual is an original. God didn't make another soul just like you. And so that helps us to understand why we are so valuable. Distinctiveness determines value. When you think about the fact that you are an original, that your soul is the real you, then we need to realize that God made us in his image, but he also gave us our individual natures, and because of that, we are valuable in his sight. God knows my name and your name. He knows who we are, and he knows all about us. And so distinctiveness determines value. Development determines value. What a thing may become had you bought several acres 40 years ago in the middle of Madison, that would be very valuable now, wouldn't it? Hope some of you did. When you think about the fact that a thing may develop and increase in value, and God sees us not for what we are at the moment, but for what we are able to become. And blessed is that parent who sees in his child, his son or his daughter, the capability and studies that and thinks about how can I help this child to develop in this direction or that direction, and makes that a great intent and study of his life, that child is blessed. Blessed is that congregation whose elders see in the lives of those whom they shepherd that here is this individual who may be able to develop into a song leader or a preacher or a teacher, or here's an individual who is gifted, and it seems like other people sort of follow his leadership, and here's a person we need to cultivate and encourage toward leadership. And so our value is determined not just by where we are at the moment, but what we may be able to become. I have a nephew who preaches not far from here. And he was showing me a book that he had written recently, and the title of the book is Headed for the Office, and it is designed for young Christian men, teenagers, who will aspire to be elders, and they are headed for the office. And so to begin even at that point in their lives to encourage and talk about the person whom they should marry and the kind of life they should live, what wisdom is in that? And so development determines value. It is said of Michelangelo, the great sculptor, that one day someone in Florence saw him looking, just staring at a great block of marble. And they said to him, "What do you see?" And he said, "I see an angel." and I'm going to release that angel. And so he was able, through his genius, to see what that block of marble might become, and to chip away everything, and to smooth away everything that was not the angel he had in his mind. And God sees in you and me not just what we are, but he sees the wonderful potential that is in all of us. I love this passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 18, which says that we all, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory unto glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. The Lord sees what you are able to become and what I'm able to become, and to see the possibilities that are before us. What a wonderful God we serve, who wants us to develop into all that we ought to be and can be. Some of you, I'm sure, have read the wonderful story written in 1850 by Nathaniel Hawthorne, The Great Stone Face. I see some people nodding. It used to be in all of the American literature books in high school. But Hawthorne wrote about a place in the Great White Mountains of New Hampshire. Some of you no doubt have seen that. And in the side of the mountain there, there was the shape of a face. In recent decades, some of those boulders have fallen away. But if you look on the state quarter for that was minted a few years ago for New Hampshire, you will see on the back of that coin the Great Stone Face. There's a legend in the valley, in the little villages below the Great Stone Face, a legend, they said, that had been handed down from the Indians who first lived there. And the legend was that some great person someday would come to that area, to that valley, and even to that little village, and would put that place on the map. It would bring great renown, and they would all recognize this individual. A little boy named Ernest heard his mother tell that story as he sat on the stone steps of their cottage, and he could see yonder in the distance the Great Stone Face. And so as he grew up, he was told many times that legend, and the people in the village would often say, as some person came to visit their village, perhaps this is the one. There was a great military leader, a man who'd grown up in that village, who had gone away, had achieved great honor, and came back home to retire. They said, surely this is the one. And they looked at him and studied him, but no, he was not the one. There was an individual who became a great shipping magnate and achieved great wealth and came back to build his retirement home in that village. And they thought, surely this individual is the one, but he was not. Finally, a poet came to that village. And at first they began, as they listened to that poet's eloquence and his readings, to say, perhaps he is the one who will bring great honor to our village. But it was the poet himself who recognized that Ernest, who had grown up there and had looked day after day, month after month, year after year, at the image of the Great Stone Face, that it was he, in his service to the people, in his preaching the simple gospel, that he had grown into the image of that face. The moral of Hawthorne's story, of course, is that we tend to grow into the image of that to which we look. The individual who studies wealth, that changes you when you do that. If that is your intent and your purpose, the individual who is set on hedonistic pleasure, and that is all his soul seeks, that changes him. The individual who has the awful tendency to view pornography is going to be changed by that. You cannot look at that time and time again without being changed by that. But the individual who looks at Jesus Christ, who looks into his word, and who studies his character, and who meditates upon him and who thinks about him, will tend to grow more and more into the image of him who died for us. And that is what this passage says to me, that as in a glass we view the glory of the Lord, we're changed into the same image from glory unto glory. Ernest, for all of his life, had looked at the image of that until finally he had grown into the image of the Great Stone Face. This passage also speaks to us of the vanity of the world. What is a man profited if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? How vain it is to seek that. No one really has ever gained the whole world. Nebuchadnezzar came close. There was a time, and he probably spoke the truth, when he walked out on the roof of his palace and viewed that great city and was lifted up with pride and thought, all of this and all of those kingdoms that are now subject to me. But he hadn't. And of course, in that very hour, it was taken from him. Hitler wanted to gain and subjugate the whole world. And for a while, as country after country fell to the Nazis, it looked as if he might dominate the whole world. Alexander the Great conquered country after country after country as a young general, as a brilliant leader, and yet he did not conquer the whole world, and no man ever will. But Jesus said, even if you could gain the whole world and lose your soul, what's it worth? I have enjoyed reading, got as a gift a book of the autobiography of Mark Twain in 2010, 100 years after his death. He had left instructions that these things were not to be published until he had been dead for 100 years. Some of you may have seen that book. And in it, he writes about the death of his little daughter, Susie, tender words. And he records her insight. And he was not really a believer. He was a skeptic, I believe that we could say safely. But Twain thought it was very significant that his little daughter, before she died, said, "What's it all about, Daddy? What's it all about?" And that is a very good question. What's it all about? If one could gain the whole world, if you could, you won't, but if you could, what's it all worth if you lose your soul? And so the vanity of the world. You think about the fact that no one has ever gained the whole world, and yet no one can ever grasp the whole world. It's amazing how cheaply people will sell Jesus. Even if you could gain the whole world for some price, for some cost, what good would it do you? I have read of the opening of the tomb of Charlemagne, who was the ruler of the Franks and who died in 814. And ruled the Romans for a while. And when Charlemagne's tomb was opened, they had buried him on a throne there in the kind of a room, a tomb. And the golden crown was still on his bony head. And in his lap was a Bible in Latin. And a bony finger was pointing to a passage. And it was this one that we're studying. What is a man profited if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Wise man to realize that and leave instructions to be buried with that before him. We cannot gratify our souls with the world. This passage teaches that. If a man could gain the whole world and yet lose his soul, how would that satisfy? The fact of the matter is that God made us for himself. We are made so that the only thing that can satisfy the craving of your soul and mine is God. He made us for himself. And a lot of people have tried all through the centuries to gratify their souls in other ways. Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 5:10, "He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase." And you can try a lot of things, and people constantly do. But God made us for himself. The only way that we will have the satisfaction that our soul craves is in God. To begin to serve him and trust him and to realize that he is what our souls were made for. In Psalms 42 and 1 and 2, there's a passage, a beautiful passage, where the psalmist expresses that. And he says, as the hart that was a little deer, as the deer panteth after the water brook, so panteth my soul after thee. Picture in your mind a little deer just panting, just so thirsty. Our souls are like that. They were made for God. My soul thirsteth for thee, for God, for the living God. And so the Bible teaches us that God, in his infinite wisdom, has made everything in a certain way. He has made the fish for the water, the birds for the air, and he has made our souls for himself. And we will never, you will never, I will never find the satisfaction that we want until we find it in God. And then this passage teaches, too, the vastness of the soul. Our soul is so big, it is so vast. We run out of superlatives when we try to describe the soul. Our soul is irreplaceable. There is no way that you can get another one. You cannot replace your soul. It's the only one that you will ever have. I came home more than 50 years ago as a young husband and found Carolyn crying. And I said, "What in the world is the matter?" And she said, "I've lost my diamond ring." And she said, "I have looked everywhere." And I looked everywhere, and we could not find it. And I said, "Darling, don't cry. I will get you another diamond ring." And I thought to myself, how will I do that? I still owe for that ring. But I went to the jeweler, and I said, "Can you get a stone of the same weight and quality as the one I bought recently?" And he said, "Yes." "And a setting?" "Just yes." "And can I pay?" "Yes." And so we replaced that diamond ring. You can get another diamond ring, but you cannot get another soul. And that little story in my life reminds me of another young husband who came home and his wife was crying. He asked her what the matter was, and she said, "Well, I made biscuits for you. I tried to make them just like your mother's, and they turned out so pretty, and I put them on a little plate and put them here on the table, and I knew it was time for you to come home, and I was out of the room just for a minute, and our little dog somehow got up there on the table and ate your biscuits." And he said, "Darling, don't cry. We can get another dog." Don't say that, men, to your wives. But the fact is, you can get another dog. You can get another diamond ring. You can replace most anything. But you cannot replace your soul. It is the only one that you will ever have. Your soul's loss is irreversible. Once your soul is lost, it is lost forever and forever. Don't you guess there will be people in the day of judgment who will say to the Lord, "Lord, now I get it. I understand. You really meant what you said about obeying the gospel. You really meant what you said. And so just give me another chance and I will be a model Christian." Well, that won't work. It is appointed unto men once to die, and after this the judgment. You will not have a second chance. You will not have another chance for forgiveness. And the preparation that you might want so desperately then to make for your soul will be unavailable. The soul's loss is irreversible. The soul's loss is immeasurable. There is no way that you can even measure. And Jesus said, "What is a man profited if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" There isn't any way to measure. It is the only thing, finally, in the end, that truly matters: the health of our soul, our being right with God. When you think about Jesus' death on the cross, you might think about that in a very, very personal way and ask yourself the question, if I were the only one, would Jesus have died for me? I think he would. I believe that he would die for me, that he died for me, and that my soul in his sight is so valuable that I can personalize that and say, Jesus died for me. And then finally, I want to say to you that losing your soul is an inexcusable loss. There's no reason for you to lose your soul. North Alabama, Madison, Alabama, is an awful place to go to torment from. There are places in the world where the gospel isn't preached very much and where it is scarce and precious. But the gospel is everywhere. In this room are a lot of people who can tell you about the gospel. And there is preaching everywhere, in churches everywhere, who are proclaiming the gospel. And to be lost from such a place, it is inexcusable. And those in this room at this moment who are listening to this lesson realize we've talked today about your soul. If you lose your soul, who is to blame? Who is to blame? What is a man profited if he gained the whole world and lose his own soul? Thank you for your good attention to our lesson this morning.